This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the 21st day of June 2011, and today I'm joined once again on the line by our old friend Lieutenant Eric Shine of MartialLaw911.com and CrossingTheRubicon.org, and of course he is also the host of In the Zone on Republic Broadcasting every Saturday night at 12 midnight Eastern, that's 9 p.m. Pacific. So thank you very much for joining us once again, Lieutenant Eric Shine. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, James.
Well, I guess it's been, I don't know, it must be almost 2 months now since we've talked on the air here, so I'm sure there's a lot going on. I don't know where you want to start, but tell us about what's going on.
You've had your plate full.
I definitely have.
Yeah. I recently worked on an article with a man named Gary Corsari. He's a Polish author and poet. You can find him on the internet. He's put out a couple of different books and a lot of different essays. Excuse me. And he helped me take one of the articles you'd probably seen before. I had done four separate articles. They weren't the easiest read. Too much information, probably a little bit too long, not as laser focused as they probably need to be. But it had gotten into, you know, the Coast Guard and Geneva Conventions and Homeland Security and how all this is being changed and morphed and altered to where it's completely unconstitutional. It's not even in keeping with, you know, let alone our own Constitution, Bill of Rights, you know, ways of life in, quote unquote, a republic, a system of self-governance of, by, and for the people. That it's not also in keeping with international agreements like Geneva Conventions. But the article was entitled The Geneva Conventions Redefined the New Department of War and went into the transformation of the Department of War Defense here in the United States that used to be known as the Department of War prior to the end of World War II. And effectively, from what's gone on and what was carried out by Bush in carrying on literally wars of aggression, you know, war crimes, and using the United States to do that towards his own ends, and which is to open up America to eventually, possibly, and himself. And I would say that, you know, the way these guys operate, he would allow himself to be prosecuted. They'd give him some kind of slap on the wrist just to bring the United States under the very same Geneva Conventions and that were the very same accords, like the International Criminal Court and other things that we've been, I guess, combating for some time. I don't think we're a signatory to the ICC yet. Or what is clearly some form of world government that is forming out of Germany in that region, you know, like Geneva, which, you know, Switzerland. But the article focused on the not only creation or transformation of the Department of Defense back into a Department of War, as it was once known for carrying on wars of aggression, offensive wars, but also the creation and the replacement of the Department of Defense with a new Department of Homeland Security, or what was to be called the Department of Homeland Defense, and also the creation of the Coast Guard, or the movement of the Coast Guard, from the Department of Transportation, where it was a civil service federal maritime police force, police and regulatory force, into not the Navy and Department of Defense, where then it would become under, you know, military law, which is the most overt form of martial law, and it would come under the Navy and under DOD and be under all the strictures and confines, just like the Department of Navy and the military and others, to where they can't be involved in police and regulatory, you know, powers or functions, to where now the Coast Guard is saying it's a full-time, full-fledged, special branch of military. That Title 10 in the UCMJ that they come under does not apply to them, that they somehow have a waiver in the prohibition against them from carrying on police regulatory powers. And so the Coast Guard is now, as a self-declared, self-defined special branch of military, as we've talked about before, carrying on administration of civilian affairs, as in my own situation, prosecuting me as a civilian within a military tribunal, and using military assets, much like what happened at Tiananmen Square, where the Chinese used military tanks against, you know, civilians carrying groceries. And then also in what happened here in the United States in the Civil War, in the case that's laid out in the movie The Conspirator and in a number of books, where Mary Surratt, who was a woman, civilian, was prosecuted, found guilty, and hung for being involved allegedly in Lincoln's assassination. And all she did was act like, you know, Ramada Inn or Holiday Inn, excuse me, and gave people who were involved, like Booth, John Wilkes Booth, a place to live, because times were tough then, so people were letting out their homes as hotels or as hostels, you know, as a place for people to live and for them to make some money. And because Booth had stayed at her house and her son was involved with Booth, they were really trying to get at her son, but since he wouldn't turn himself in, they hung her and found her guilty of treason and being involved in the assassination, which is, you know, questionable at least. But there's also a case from 1957, Reed versus Covert, which pretty much laid this out, where it's a U.S. Supreme Court case, one of the only cases in the United States where it was reconsidered by the same sitting of the same Supreme Court, where they overturned themselves, where initially in 56, it was found by the Supreme Court that trying Mrs. Reed, in a military tribunal for the murder of her husband — she's not in the military, he was, she's a dependent who was serving, he was serving in England at the time, and she was prosecuted in a military tribunal, found guilty of his murder. And to me, it smacks of, you know, cover up. Someone else murdered him and she was blamed for it because she was easy mark. Because at some point, a civilian is not on notice of the rules of codes of conduct of the UCMJ Title 10. And it's unfair and, you know, a violation of our Constitution to force someone under that system who has not voluntarily agreed to come under it and be, you know, because our military system is really for going after, it's not really intended for, and it has become for this, even internal, conduct correction or whatever. It was supposed to be a, much like Title V and the Administrative Procedure Act for civil service employees, it was supposed to be an internal remedial system where life, liberty, and property could not be taken away from you. It was to find an internal remedy that didn't include taking life, liberty, and property, and that are only our independent judiciary, Article 3, through a jury trial of your peers, could take away life, liberty, or property. That's one of our foundational systems or prescriptions or proscriptions in our republic to limit government, because our founders realized how, and as we're seeing now today in all regards, how unconstrained not only the dogs of war can become once unleashed, but how ravenous people can become when herded and set on a particular person or mission or, I guess, course of action, and how the body politic can somehow take it over, and everything as far as due process, the presumption of innocence, and many other things are thrown out the window, as what has happened in my own situation. But in 1957, the Supreme Court overturned its earlier ruling in 1956 in Reed versus Covert. And Hugo Black, Chief Justice, I think he was Chief Justice, but he was the justice who wrote the majority opinion for the Supreme Court at the time, went all the way back to the Magna Carta and laid out why we don't allow the military to involve itself in civilian affairs, let alone adjudicate civilian affairs. And they laid out in the decision, you know, back, and this is back in the 50s, we've got trains, planes, and automobiles, and there's absolutely no reason that we can't get an individual back to a regular federal district court to where all of their rights and protections that are inalienable, that anyone that becomes into our a court system here in the United States, whether they're an alleged terrorist, an alleged murderer, and this is the bar was set very high at murder, so that you can't get at anything less. You can't get at, the military can't get at trying a civilian for murder or anything less. And but what they've done, like in my own situation, and what they've pushed more and more in even militarizing our police to a large extent, is to throw out the presumption of innocence. Homeland Security has been instrumental in this. The Pentagon has been instrumental in this, Department of Defense and more. And, I mean, to the point now that it's even popping up here in the United States, reports about debtors' prisons in the South and other areas where people are being fined and have to post a bond to get out of prison to make a minimum payment on their debt to be released to go ahead and, you know, get out and somehow make good on their arrears.
Right, absolutely. Well, that's quite a mouthful, but that just goes to show the scope and the breadth of what we're dealing with here. And that is an awful lot to take in, but I think that that people who have either heard our conversations before or who go and read this new article that you've worked on with Gary Corsari will be able to really understand the scope of this and the really the important nature of this information. And people can find it. It got spread quite widely to a lot of big sites like Dissident Voice and others. It's on Dissident Voice, for example, under the title Geneva Conventions Redefined. So I'll post a link in the notes for this interview. But tell us about that. How did that come about? How did you get in touch with Gary Corsari, and how did you start working on this article?
Well, Gary was on my show. He had written something about Bradley Manning. I think he'd done a poem about Bradley Manning. And it was either that poem or another one. I believe it was the one on Bradley Manning. Gary thinks it was a different poem. But regardless, I contacted him, had him come on my program. It took a little bit of pursuit. He didn't have the time. He was in the midst of stuff. And he said, after such and such a date. And so I kept on it and pressed him and followed up and got him on my program where he had read some of his poems. And I'm trying to think if he read the, got into a couple of them. The archive is on Republic Broadcasting Network at republicbroadcasting.org. I encourage people to purchase a subscription so they can go in and not just get the archives of my programs, but and you know, you're on in a bunch of those programs for quite some time as a guest host, co-host, for, I don't know, was it 6 months at least, maybe more,
something like that. Yeah,
so there's a bunch of really, you know, good programs, and I, you know, ask people to listen to them, and a lot of good information. But Gary was on the program. We archived it. Had some trouble getting it to him, the archive, because I'm using Gmail predominantly, and they have limits on sizes. And then I hit him up on helping me with an article and trying to help me rewrite it. And he was kind enough to consider it. And then eventually I finagled him into working on it with me. And he received a byline because of, you know, he had some really good contributions to it. One thing he did at the very beginning is he had added in the quote from Shakespeare, "What's in a name?" And I guess that's from the balcony scene between Romeo and Juliet when they're talking about their last names and the conflict between the two families and stuff. And
wherefore art thou Romeo? You know, as an English major, I should probably know off the top of my head, but I actually don't.
Right.
Oh, well.
And when he mentioned it and explained it, it you know, reminded me of my knowledge of it, but it took him to, but he had added that in and a bunch of other like key points. He also added in the part on knights errant and knights aberrant and a lot of little good, you know, turns of the tongue that really helped pump up the article. And the key was to get it knocked down to 1,000 words to try to focus it on one issue in all of this, which was basically the conversion of DOD into the Department of War again. And the, you know, what really went on, which people don't realize, it was the splitting of the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, into two, into an offense department and a defense department.
That's exactly right. And tell people again what the significance of that is.
It's just, well, because it not only shakes the foundations of our country to the roots in separation of powers doctrine, which created our Article 1 Congress that's supposed to make the laws, the legislature, and our Article 2 executive that's supposed to enforce the laws. You know, I was thinking about this yesterday. The executive branch really isn't even supposed to be not legislating by executive order, of course, but also the executive branch, it's a conflict of interest for it to even propose legislation, because it's the one who's going to enforce the legislation. So, I mean, when you think about it, in its highest form, the executive branch should really just be following the law, enforcing the law, making sure that the law is, you know, as the police and regulatory branch, carried out as Congress intended. Yeah, I think even in the one Supreme Court case that just came out with Walmart, it might not have been the Walmart case that we talked about before the program, but in it, it was basically saying, the court said, and this was like either a district or circuit court, you know, federal district court, I think it might have been circuit appellate, so it was pretty high up the food chain in the, you know, workings of things in our legal system. To where they said that it wasn't upon the court to determine the intent of Congress. And I was like, what? That's the whole purpose of the court, is to...
Exactly. What else does the court do but try to rule on legislation?
Well, right, and to go back to your original intent of why Congress passed the law, which is because a bunch of people were pushing for it. That's, you know, the main reason. The executive branch isn't supposed to be pushing for law. It's not supposed to be writing law. But that's what happened in the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. And I've put out there for quite some time, our country is not going to be restored to any kind of semblance of what it was before until the Department of Homeland Security is abolished.
Well, on the note of the executive and its reason for existing, I was listening to a very interesting conversation on the latest Boiling Frogs Post podcast with Sibel Edmonds and Peter B. Collins, and they were talking to Lou Rockwell, and he was talking about how the original Articles of Confederation didn't even have an executive. In fact, the original revolutionaries didn't want an executive at all in the system of government they were setting up, but that eventually came out of the Philadelphia Constitutional Convention, obviously. So I have absolutely no idea about that history. I'm not American. I haven't, you know, really studied that to a great deal, but I found that really interesting.
Well, and that's part of the problem, though, in having an executive where everybody below him is supposed to be a, you know, not a civil servant, but a, whether they're in the military or not, they are supposed to be, quote unquote, a public servant. They serve the rule of law, the Constitution, not the president. And if you remember Colin Powell, who was also knighted by the Queen of England, I note, Colin Powell said, I serve at the president's leisure or at his will or however he you know, phrased it at the time. And that's really not how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be, look, you know, you go through the process, you nominate people, Congress vets them, and once they're in there, sorry, that's it. And you're not supposed to remove them just through a stroke of will. It's supposed to be through due process. Because at some point, if you bring in people that disagree with you at some point, that they may be yes-men and agree with you, and at some point they grow a spine, or they had one all along and you didn't know it, and you think that you're putting in somebody that's going to do what they're told, and they don't, and they stand up for the rule of law and say, no, you can't do this. This isn't right. I'm not going to be part of this. Because that's all it takes is one person. Like in my own situation, if somebody within the National Transportation Safety Board had spine and had an understanding of the ramifications of what they're sitting on and ruling on, and I believe that's part of what's going on. I mentioned to you about Department of Education coming after me for $30,000 for student loans that were used to get me through Kings Point Merchant Marine Academy to get me in and through and out. And they're coming after me because I had stopped paying on those because the Department of Homeland Security and Coast Guard were prosecuting me, stealing medical records, falsifying medical records, put out a BOLO, be on the lookout warning, wanted poster on me saying I may be dangerous, and all sorts of other stuff. So I was a little preoccupied. Plus, they've had me in these proceedings without pay. So there's no, you know, or per diem or legal counsel or any of the other things I'm supposed to get. And I've even tried to go to the union as there's been a change in leadership in the union, and there's been no real change in leadership in the union. It's the same, you know, quote unquote union bosses. Even this guy is a naval officer himself, but he didn't go to my academy, Calhoun, or any of the state maritime academies. He went to the union school. And these guys from Calhoun, the union school, hate guys from my academy. And I don't know if it's kind of like the whole, I'm trying to think of the tax collector from biblical times that was up in the tree and, you know, looking down and listening to Christ, where, you know, the people hated him and he was kind of hiding up in the tree and stuff because he was a tax collector for the national government. And I don't know if it's because I'm a federal officer, naval officer, part of what some people would call the establishment. And I'm not, obviously, you know, I mean, I don't find myself in the situation I'm in because I'm quote unquote part of the establishment. I'm probably more anti-establishment myself. I don't believe that, you know, we should be passing, we've talked about this before, like Congressman Duncan Hunter Sr. passing his seat, a congressional seat down in San Diego, to his son, Congressman Duncan Hunter Jr., which is just one sign of what is going on in the bigger picture, to where positions of power and trust, whether they be public in public service in the government or private in corporations and more, even NGOs, which are taking on the role of government now, you know, they're like a private, you know, it's like Bill Gates started an NGO. So it started having the Department of Health and Human Services doing something beneficial for the people instead of like trying to, you know, RFID tag us all or whatever with Verichip and what Tommy Thompson was up to before. It actually served the public and protected the public. But to now where these NGOs are replacing what the government's supposed to do as a true public trust, and to where they're owned and controlled, these NGOs, non-governmental organizations, to not only replace what government was doing, but to be owned and controlled by people like Bill Gates, Melinda Gates. I'm trying to think of what Melinda Gates's maiden name is, because she's tied into this whole series of corporate families. And of course, Warren Buffett, who is tied, you know, strongly to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that is doing all this stuff for medical research, to where a family, an individual, a couple, and their enormously wealthy friend are setting policy for the world for medical issues rather than having it come of, by, and for the people.
Right, and it's all for the greater good of humanity because they just love people so much, and that's why Bill Gates goes around saying that he wants to reduce the population through vaccines, and no one bats an eyelid when he says it, and absolutely. Are you familiar with the proceedings of the Rees Committee from the 1950s?
I know the name, and I know that there was, like, the Church Commission was another one where they went into the whole mob influence with unions and a lot of other stuff, and even to where federal employers, large state and national and international employers were actually working with the union. Like in my own situation, the union stood in federal district court and protected the shipping companies, federal contractors. But you'd have to refresh my memory on the Rees Commission.
It was in the 1950s, a congressional committee that was looking into the foundations that were founded by the robber barons at the turn of the 20th century. And it was basically looking at whether they were involved in un-American activities, which was, of course, the catch-all phrase back in the 50s. But Norman Dodd, who was the chief researcher for that commission, was actually granted access to the minutes of the Carnegie Endowment from the actual inception of the fund. And basically found how they were angling to get the United States involved in war, and they cut a deal with the Rockefellers to basically direct the course of American education by controlling scholarships and things like that, and it was all right there in the minutes of the endowment itself, and it was all on congressional record, but it's all been quite covered up, and no one really talks about it anymore. But just startling stuff.
There's an article about that out recently, or a piece, and I had read some of it. The thing about that, too, though, is I'm trying to remember if it was 62 or 60. I think it was 63. Kennedy's speech on secret societies. That's what these foundations really are. They're secret societies where they put their own friends and family and other individuals in there to run the foundation, and it's really a subversive fifth column.
There's no question about that, especially when Rockefeller brags in his own memoirs about how he is a committed internationalist who is seeking to form a one-world government, and he's the one, you know, who's chairing all of these dozens and dozens of different bodies, or he has been until I think he's now like 97 years old or something like that, but he's been doing a phenomenal amount of work and devoting untold amount of resources to this, and all tax-free, because, of course, all these charitable institutions are beyond the arm of the government.
Yeah, and it's very scary. If you look into, like, even, I think there was something about the Bilderbergs and Bill Gates and, of course, Robert Gates being attendees at the most recent. And I'm not sure if it was the Bilderbergers or the
They were attending this year's Bilderberg in St. Moritz, Switzerland, along with Eric Schmidt and the founder of PayPal and lots of other.
But you don't find it coincidental that there's two people named Gates? That's, remember what I've been saying about, like, if you look back into, like, what the Stuarts did in Europe as a quote-unquote royal family, and how they basically just, you know, I don't want to say wiped out, impoverished, and, you know, held Europe for ransom, but more or less the very same system of families, because it wasn't just the Stuarts. There was all sorts of families that benefited from and were, you know, pariahs or lampreys, you know, attached to the Stuart family, just like with Hitler. Hitler didn't arise to power on his own. There was a lot of other little Hitlers who not only helped him get in place, but stay in place. And what I mean by that is a lot of other little dictators of the same mind who had no problem with what Hitler was doing in World War II.
Right. And prior to. A dictator can't flourish in a vacuum. I mean, there's obviously a context and people who are supporting that infrastructure to make that happen.
Right, and any, I don't care if you're a king or you're the a president of a republic, any leader who puts on a uniform is a military dictator. Like I think Pinochet did, Noriega did, Bush did, Obama has now. I don't care if it's for a moment, because, and we've talked about this before, how the president is supposed to have, and does have, special clothes that are different. Not like, you know, if you go out on a military, if you're going to fly in a military craft to get out to a military vessel, like an aircraft carrier, you don't do it in military garb. They make clothes for the president if they have to. But this goes back even to the issue of, you know, like you brought up initially or thereafter, was about many people, and I think Hamilton was one of them, but Hamilton was also a devout, quote unquote, world federalist, if not even royalist or loyalist to this, you know, concept of a core system of families and their brethren ruling the world, an elite class, a self-appointed, non-elected, or if they are elected through, you know, machinations of playing with the Electoral College and other gamesmanships. But there was many comments that when Washington became our first president, not just the arguments over what to call him, you know, governor, president, your excellency, whatever, of whether or not we were just simply electing a king, whether it be for 4 years or 8 years or on into perpetuity, almost like what Roosevelt had, you know, done himself into four terms. And a lot of people looked at Roosevelt as like a good guy and somebody who'd done something good in New Deal, and I believe there's good and bad, just like with Lincoln and Kennedy and others. Lincoln tried to bring back in and get a hold of our monetary system, as did Kennedy. But Kennedy was also involved in the assassination of President Diem in Vietnam, or at least it happened under his watch. And I'm not sure if he actually had ordered it or it happened, much like what Oliver North had done and with Reagan and Iran-Contra, and, you know, even what people say happened with Nixon with G. Gordon Liddy and the plumbers, that Nixon allegedly, and some people believe that he was directly involved, but allegedly Nixon didn't have knowledge, and where he screwed up was he stepped in to cover up for his guys, and that's what really got him by the, you know, goat hairs of his chinny chin chin.
Right. Well, yeah, and there is significant evidence that the break-in was bungled. I mean, they botched it horribly, which you would not expect seasoned CIA to have done. So it,
well, part of that involved Ellsberg as well, didn't it?
And the Pentagon. Right. Yeah, they were trying to break into his psychologist's office to get his files and things like that. Yeah.
And then you look at what they've done with me, where they've used, you know, they've said that I said that evil spirits possess me at times. I've never said that. They've put out that I'm somehow connected to Timothy McVeigh. I'm not. I have absolutely no connection to him, other than I put in a whistleblower letter to the Secretary of Transportation that we can't allow incidents like McVeigh to go unchecked, and that we, you know, any kind of domestic terrorism by a quote-unquote apparent patriot, somebody who, you know, used to serve in the military or whatever, just opens up conduits for international terrorism. And they use that to somehow say that I'm connected to Timothy McVeigh. It's like, no. And even the Coast Guard said, well, we don't know why he said that. And it's like, so why wouldn't you ask? Why wouldn't you, you know, inquire? Or why wouldn't you read the letter, you know? And in this whole proceeding, they've tried to say that, I have superhuman traits, that because I can write a 40-page letter overnight, which there's no proof of that. There's no proof that I wrote the 40-page letter overnight. They're just, you know, and they even said in the proceedings, this is a Captain French Coast Guard officer, a medical officer, saying that it doesn't matter what the letters say. It's just the fact that he can write such a long letter in such a short period of time. It's like,
That's proof of what exactly?
Yeah. Well, supposedly manic, you know, manic depressive, whatever, which is what they're trying to prove, and doing it by attacking me to make me depressed and then backing off. And I'm in a flurry to try to get help, find help, you know, defend myself, whatever, somehow. And they basically set up the system to train you through this very bizarre and torturous, you know, program, to where at the end of it, if you weren't, you know, something wrong with you, just like they did with Padilla, where through sensory deprivation, and this is sensory deprivation, I'm being deprived of the life that I should be leading as a naval officer, as an officer in the United States Merchant Marine, as a graduate of Kings Point, all the things that I fought hard for and earned were stripped away from me without due process, and to where they've used false accusations and evidence that they actually trumped up and created, to where the Coast Guard said that I said that evil spirits possessed me at times. And I've never said that. They even had an answer sheet to a questionnaire on this, and I answered, you know, the statement was evil spirits possess me at times, true or false, and I answered false. They changed the answers and presented it to their own little court themselves as if I had answered it true, and we caught them on it. And you know, this is when I still had counsel, and we, you know, contested it, and then they tried to blame me for that I was somehow misleading the court and blah blah blah.
That's just phenomenal. I mean, it's just so brazen and in your face, it almost can't be accounted for.
It's in the transcripts. It's up online. People can go review it at the two websites that you mentioned, you know, crossingtherubicon.org and martiallaw911.com, martiallaw911.com. And it's the Department of Homeland Security, Coast Guard, Department of Transportation was in there, and they removed them. The United States of America, who have brought charges against me, not for murder, not for breaking the law, but they charged me with being depressed. And they've tried to prove that and gone further rather than just trying to prove that I'm depressed, since I won't agree to it and confess that they've tortured me and that I'm not happy about it. That they're going to do worse to me the more I continue to try and fight and, you know, stay alive and keep my head above water. And they're using, like, the letter I just got from the Department of Education coming after me, to where, to defend myself in this instance, I either have to find some kind of angel to pay this off, which I've been seeking for God knows how long now, and I'd still really like some angel to step forward, but I don't see it happening anytime soon, if at all. But not just on this, you know, if it was paid off, then it would go away to an extent. But one of the things I mentioned to you in the break was, say they, instead of somebody else paying it off and stepping in or whatever, say that Department of Education, or it gets referred to the Department of Treasury. And guess where the Coast Guard used to be? Department of Treasury. They get to decide whether they're going to forgive it or not. And to get it forgiven, I have to say that I'm mentally disabled. And I'm not the one saying that I'm quote-unquote medically or mentally disabled. The Coast Guard and Homeland Security is, but they've effectively blocked me, even though I've been fighting it, from serving in my industry, chosen profession, for minimally the last 8 years. And so, in a defense, I'm going to say, look, I'm not saying I'm medically, mentally incompetent, but the Coast Guard is. And even in that, even if I'm saying, like, look, I'm not saying this, the Coast Guard is, they could rule and forgive the loan and say that they're doing it because he's medically, mentally incompetent and he's put this forth and whatever. This would, you know, support the Coast Guard's case. They would use it. They've already used a deferment that I had asked for on the student loan back when all this stuff started, as evidence against me, as a confession, where they're saying that was a confession, where I'm saying that I'm permanently medically, mentally incompetent. And I never said that. I was under attack. I was in federal district court going after the shipping companies and union, and they beat the living hell out of me. And they used law firms like Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. That's the same law firm that represented Bush, George W., against Al Gore at the Supreme Court to come after me, which is not only an international law firm, it has strong British, royal, United Kingdom, crown ties. Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. And all these you also find are like large corporate families. Like there's a paint company called Dunn Edwards. And Edwards is another, like John Edwards, another one of these large corporate, and I would say international, if not even European, fascist, for want of a better word, families that use the government to bestow great benefits upon them, their family, and their friends. It's the same racket that was run under the kingdoms and under the royal families and the crown families, to where those who supported the system had great, you know, not only titles of lord and baron and more, but they were the ones who got the contracts. They were the ones who got the access to own and control an entire industry, like, you know, Bill Gates with Silicon, not just Silicon Valley, but with the technology and computer industry.
Right. So, I mean, it's pretty much the very definition of oligarchy. It's the very few families that get to share in the wealth of the entire empire, however that's defined.
Yeah, whether it's a republic or a kingdom. And the thing is, you know, like here in the United States, same thing as in, you know, starting 10 Downing and working your way out, the United Kingdom, the Commonwealth, many of these family names, if not most or all, you'll find on street signs. And if you just pay attention, look around, you go, I've heard that name before. Oh my God, that's that, you know, like Edwards, Kerry, like as in John Kerry, McCain and others. These people get their name on street signs for a reason. Or even on coliseums, sports stadiums, you know, like, excuse me, Qualcomm was, it used to be known as San Diego Stadium, and then it was Jack Murphy Stadium, and Murphy was a public servant who helped, I think, build or get the stadium built. And then after naming it in honor of Jack Murphy, that's the whole slippery slope. Instead of just calling it San Diego Stadium, owned and controlled by the people, it becomes Qualcomm. And whether it's a corporate name, like I believe Qualcomm goes to Quality Communications, abbreviated to an extent, it's not necessarily a family name. Some of these family names, like Staples, you've probably heard of Staples Center, and Staples, the office, you know, supply store, there's actually a family named Staples. Like Hearst.
And that's the owner of Staples?
There's a connection there to the family.
Okay.
Well, that's Melinda Gates. I'm trying to think of her. I can't think of it offhand, and I'll find it here in a sec. But Melinda Gates' maiden name is another one of these families that, and this is what the royals did in Europe. They would intermarry, and in doing so, exchange land, property, titles, DNA, wealth, and basically marry the, you know, everything inherent to one family into the other to build a greater power base. And it's like what they did with Princess Diana and in Charles having children through Diana. There's also some people they had called in the show, Barbara from California. She's called in before, but she called into my program this past weekend, and she mentioned how many of the Dutch royals, I think three of the main ones, have all married Germans in the last 5-10 years. So these connections continue, just like I've mentioned before, how the Bush family Bush-Davis-Walker family or families are, it's just like Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. That was what the Windsor's name was before they changed it. And these, you know, like Windsor is one name, but their name before was Saxe as in one family name, Coburg as in another family name, and Gotha as in another family name, to where they're marrying together these enormously powerful houses or family names and their estates. And their, you know, and this is something that Martin Bormann was involved with in Nazi Germany, in taking the capital, intellectual property, names, wealth, blueprints, copyrights, trademarks, and more of over 750 of these enormous corporate families out of Germany prior to the fall of Germany, and moving these quote-unquote seedlings throughout the world to take over and work within certain other countries, whether it be Argentina, Brazil, even here in the United States, Canada, and other places, to where they've used them to, for want of a better way of saying it, to cement or to establish or to create some kind of firmament of these, the extensions of these large corporate families that trace their roots back hundreds, if not thousands of years in Europe, if not all around the world. You know, one of the things that Bush created was this not just rainbow coalition of the willing, but it was a rainbow coalition of the willing fascist families who wanted to benefit from these ongoing wars, invasions into, I mean, can you see any way that Afghanistan and Iraq were not wars of aggression, that were not illegal wars by the international conventions, Geneva Conventions?
Certainly not, and they were certainly premeditated, and the plans were ready to go well before 9/11.
Right, and even, you know, and then you look at 9/11 and what happened there, and that's, I guess there's stories out now or reports about that. Basically, the media has been ordered not to cover or talk about 9/11.
Actually, but, yeah, Daniel Ellsberg was just saying that.
Yeah, exactly. I saw that story. That was, but I mean, if you think about it, Neil Bush, who was involved with No Child Left Behind and all sorts of other good fun stuff, where he's ripping off people, he was on the security firm, on the board of the security firm that had, that did security for the World Trade Center, and the contract ended the day before 9/11.
Are you sure that wasn't Marvin Bush?
No, you're right. Marvin Bush, sorry. Neil was the one involved with the No Child Left Behind and the whole, and he was also involved with the savings and loan scandal. But, you know, this family is well known for their corruptions and their games. And if you look into the Davis-Walker family that they're married into, and who turned over, you know, governorship of California to Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's an Austrian citizen who won't renounce his citizenship, and is married into the Kennedy family that's tied back to England
was
as well.
Married into the Kennedy family.
Well, yeah, but his children are still of, you know, that family, the ties and bonds.
That's right. Well, at least his political career has been ruined. There is a bright side.
I never say, I would not say that, but I don't think he's going to, you know, fare as well as he might have if he, you know, wasn't getting divorced and all sorts of other fun stuff going on. But our country is so, seriously, with the way things are right now, Arnold Schwarzenegger could actually get elected president.
You know, as ridiculous and horrifying as that is, it actually isn't so far from the truth, is it? I mean, all of the pieces are in place for just unbridled executive authority to be unleashed on the American public, and the American public not only to not see it as a threat, but to actually cheer it on as it comes.
Yeah, to embrace it, right?
Yeah, it's
because what they will look for is that dictatorial father figure that would step in rough times and say, you know, I have the way. I know you just have to follow and do what I tell you to do. And
it's so right. And people will go for it. And the worst part is we haven't even reached those rough times yet. And we have to wait for something. Well, yeah, exactly. There are more and more people who are falling into that, but still,
well, But that's where at some point, you know, whether it's you who lives in a commonwealth, a kingdom, or I who live in a limited republic, a constitutional, you know, republic, we both live in common law countries. And so what happens to one individual can be carried out and used against all other individuals.
That's it. Well, we are coming towards the end of our conversation, so any final thoughts you'd like to leave listeners with today?
I would really like some help. I don't know why I still even try or why I'm asking, and I mean, I could really use legal counsel, could use a defense fund, could use financial help, could use some angel coming in and buying off my debt and getting me out of the clutches of not only the federal government, but also these corporations. I don't see that happening. I'll have to continue to try and fight as long as I possibly can to keep these forces at bay, at least in my own life. But, we are our brother's keeper. And the more that we turn a blind eye to what's going on around us, the more it's going to smack us upside the head because we're not paying attention to it and trying to confront it when it greets our neighbor at their doorstep. And instead, you know, it's just like a fire. If a fire breaks out and it's consuming your neighbor's house, you don't say, well, it's not my house. You realize that it may very soon be your house because the fire may jump the fence or consume the fence and then work its way towards your house, and that, oh, wait, that is my neighbor, and I'm good friends with them. They're nice people. Or if you're not, it doesn't matter. That's when you, at some point, to the greater cause, the you know, common cause, you forget about those petty rivalries, those petty jealousies, those issues of personality. And you go to principles and you realize that this is too big, too important, and you step forward to be counted and you start grabbing buckets and do whatever's necessary to put out the fire. And then, you know, it goes even deeper than that, that if you stop there, that doesn't help your neighbor and it doesn't help you, because if you don't help your neighbor get back up on his feet, rebuild his home, it affects you. And I hate to go to this economic a common denominator, but it affects the value of your house. If you have a charred, burnt down home sitting next to you, it destroys your own quality of life. And at some point, we are all living on this planet together. And although those who are in power, who should be showing leadership and putting a kibosh on things like what's going on with me, making sure that, like what happened in Japan with Fukushima, was prevented, that those nuclear power plants are, you know, if they're going to use them and they want to use nuclear power, then 20 years. That's the life of the plant. Technology moves too fast. In 20 years, the number of advances, it's time to build a new plant and to plan to take apart safely that plant and replace it with something newer, better, that's up to the latest standards and technology and everything that we've learned in the last 20 years. That's how they used to do it in the Merchant Marine. Ships were built to last a lifespan of 20 years. And because of everything that's gone on, like with the one upgrade was a double hull tanker, and they grandfathered and just allowed vessels to go around with single hull. And we've seen what happened, like with the Exxon Valdez and other ships. I think the Valdez, it wasn't a double hull tanker. It had other tanks that were outside, like water tanks and more, but it wasn't a true double hull tanker. But if we kept the standards up and did the right thing and didn't just go to money, we would all, rich and poor, be living in a better world, a better state. And even the rich, you know, if they would wake up and realize that it doesn't behoove them to attack the people that are trying to make it a better world for all of us, which is basically the average Joe and Jane, you know, the people who want to work hard, do their job, do the right thing, and realize that, you know, act as true public servants, whether they're working for a private corporation or in true public service, not for profit, in a governmental agency or department, whether it be in a constitutional monarchy, a kingdom, or a constitutional republic, as we have, we all need to start setting aside some of these differences. And I'm not talking about New World Order type stuff. I'm saying that, you know, we really need to start banding together and stop the attacks against people like myself and others. Ellsberg is a perfect example, who are being obliterated. They don't want whistleblowers. They don't want complainants. They don't want people speaking the truth, especially to power.
Unfortunately, that's the case, but since we are here and we still have voices, we will continue to do that. So we will end the conversation there, but we will be talking to you again in the near future. So until then, Lieutenant Eric Schein, please stay strong. 911.com and crossingtherubicon.org. Thanks for joining us once again today.
Thanks, James. Peace.